Hello, and welcome.
Radio.
Mission. I'm Adam Ferens, and I'm joined tonight by Cindy Collins-Smith. Say hello.
Hi.
Yep. And tonight, as you can guess by the music, that topic at hand tonight is Doctor Who. This time, the 2005 relaunch of the series. Now, Doctor Who, of course, ran originally from 1963 to 1989, and this was followed by what the fans have come to refer to as the wilderness years, a period where, aside from one TV movie and a questionable crossover with EastEnders, the Doctor did not make an appearance on television. There were, however, books and comic strips and audio adventures featuring the 6th, 7th, and 8th Doctors, among many others. However, it was not until 2003 when the BBC decided to bring the series back under the guidance of writer-producer Russell T. Davies. And in March of 2005, Doctor Who was back on our TV screens with Christopher Eccleston as the 9th Doctor. So, Cindy,
yes.
What was it like for you when Doctor Who came back, or did you come to the show a little later?
I actually came to the show a little bit later. I was on a fan board for the Harry Potter series, a UK-based fan board, and a lot of my friends were watching Doctor Who. So I got interested, you know, I'd heard of Doctor Who way back in like the 90s, I guess, but I hadn't actually seen any episodes. So, of course, I initially went back to the very beginning, and the very first Doctor Who serial that I ever saw was the first Dalek serial. But I noticed that what my friends were doing was watching the new Doctor Who episodes. So I kind of gravitated over to that and started, you know, backtracking and watched all the Chris Eccleston stuff, and then I came through the other Doctors and got caught up. So I got caught up with it right in time for Matt Smith's first Christmas special, actually. That's when I got caught up. So that's when I started watching, right around then.
Mm.
That's pretty late.
So you managed to
but,
yeah. So
yeah,
you
but I did catch up very quickly. I'm sorry.
No, I was going to say, so you caught up on, and by that, you watched everything you could find from the original run, yes?
I watched a lot of stuff from the original run, yes. I haven't seen everything, but I you know, scoured Netflix and Amazon, and, you know, I watched a good number of William Hartnell episodes. I've watched the Second Doctor, the Third Doctor. Not much of the Fourth Doctor, but only because there's such a massive amount, you know. So percentage-wise, I haven't seen a significant percentage of the Fourth Doctor. I've seen some Fifth Doctor. I have seen a little bit of the Sixth and none of the Seventh, and I've seen the Eighth movie.
Cool. Well, I will just say for you and anyone else who wants to watch this, if you can't afford the DVDs, which can sometimes be exorbitantly priced, Amazon and I believe BritBox have the series. BritBox has the original run, but they don't have the missing episodes, only some of the reconstructions. So it's not a complete set, but it's as close to a complete set as one can really hope to get. But yes,
well, And the reconstructions, you know, that's nice. I mean, the reconstruction stuff. I mean, the fact that they're
able to
do that
now. Yeah, and I guess
there's
the new reconstruction out now.
Yeah, I heard that. I heard that there's one, is it BritBox that has, like, all the episodes and the reconstructions as well?
That's the one. Yep, that's it.
Yeah.
And I'm definitely looking forward to getting a chance to dive back into that, because of course, as the listeners found out, if they are returning from the first of these two Doctor Who episodes, I was unfortunately forced to sell my entire Doctor Who run a few years ago. But I'll get it back one day. But at least there's streaming. But enough of a digression for that. The series as we have it now has had obviously many highs and many lows, both in terms of ratings and critical reception. But do you have a favorite Doctor of the new run of Doctors?
I was thinking about that because I'm very much a Capaldi partisan and thought that he got short shrifted on a lot of stuff. But if I had to talk about a Doctor that I thought was most fully realized and also supported by the writers, had a good run and all of that, it would actually go to David Tennant. And not because he's the cute one, you know, but because he really was supported by the writers, had a great run of episodes, had a good long run as the Doctor. And, you know, what Eccleston started, and Eccleston was brilliant, but he only had the one season, but what Eccleston started, Tennant made sure that this show continued. And so, you know, he really solidified it. And then, of course, the Matt Smith era is what really exported it around the world. So, you know, it's like each of the Doctors, the first three of the Doctors, really played a big role in its iconic status around the world now. I mean, in popular culture. I don't mean like the niche culture that it used to be in the United States. You know, now it's more mainstream.
Yeah, it definitely became a hit, you know, Eccleston brought it back in the UK, and then Tennant, and to a lesser degree, but Smith certainly helped bring the show to, you know, worldwide attention in a way it had never had before. And part of that was their appeal. Part of that was some of the writing, especially early in Smith's tenure. But I think it also helped that we finally started getting the show on a regular basis in the United States and other parts of the world on as close to a simulcast as possible. So,
yeah,
you know, you didn't have to resort to alternative methods as many fans did.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the day that they started showing Doctor Who on the same day, and I think that was I'm looking at it right now. I think that it was actually with The Impossible Astronaut. I think that was the first one.
Yes.
Wasn't that?
Yes.
Episodes. I think the Christmas episode might have been on the same day as well, but I think that was the first actual episode.
Yeah, we started getting it a few hours after it aired in the UK. The first actual episode to air at the same time was, of course, the 50th anniversary episode, which I know some people like to knock it. I thought that was beautifully done.
Oh, I thought it was beautiful. I thought that was just a fabulous episode. One of the best things Moffat ever wrote during his time as a showrunner.
Yes, yes. Now that's something we can get into before we go into favorite episodes. But what if you had to pick one thing that separates Davies as a showrunner and Moffat as a showrunner, what would it be?
Character versus plot. Davies was more interested in character development, and Moffat was more interested in plot convolutions.
Yes, yes, and I think this
do you
especially
want me to elaborate,
became apparent in the sixth series that began with The Impossible Astronaut. Now, I did not like that series when it first aired. Upon a second viewing, I see how it all fit, how it all always fit together. But, you know, Babylon 5 is a show that had a lot of pre-planning, and as the pieces fell into place, you went, oh, yeah, that makes total sense. That's not the case with the sixth series of the relaunched Doctor Who. And I think that that's because Moffat sometimes got too cute, too clever for his own good.
I would totally agree with that. I think that it worked in the sixth season. I mean, I do think it worked because it was kind of our first exposure to Moffat's tendency to to get really convoluted and to have the plot kind of collapsing on itself, and you almost have to get a flow chart to figure out how all this works. But it's really in the later seasons with Moffat where it becomes a serious liability. And yeah.
And I honestly hate that final Capaldi season. I thought that Bill was an interesting companion that never got an interesting episode, and that Capaldi was completely and totally wasted in that season.
Almost totally wasted. Yeah, I would agree pretty much. When I wrote down season 10 for episodes that I really liked, I just wrote, I don't have good memories of it. And, you know, what I remember about season 10, I think that's the number of the season, is that in that season, you know, you'd be watching an episode and you'd be liking the episode, and then it would get to the last 15 minutes of the episode and it would just collapse. And
yeah.
That was like with that house episode, which was, I was really enjoying it until it got to the resolution, which was just like idiotic, you know? And so it's like that happened like repeatedly in that season. It's like you're watching it, you're enjoying it, you think, okay, this is going to be the episode I'm going to like. And then they just pull it out from under you, you know, at the very last 15 minutes or something, and you're like,
you know, it occurs to me what my issue with Moffat might be. It might not just be that he has all this convoluted mess that seems convoluted for its own sake, but his resolutions are insulting to the audience's intelligence.
Yes. Well, you know, one of the episodes that I actually have down, I made a list before we started, and one of the episodes that I actually listed as memorably bad episodes was an episode that's not really terrible. I think a lot of people actually probably love it, but Closing Time, and it's like the resolution to that is what kills the episode for me. It's like, you know, the character, I can't remember his name, but he's a character we meet in Matt Smith's first season, and becomes his roommate. Remember the Lodger episode? And in Closing Time,
by,
he revisits him.
Corden, James Corden.
Yeah. And he revisits that character in Closing Time. And in the very end, it's like, you know, he's been turned into a Cyberman, but guess what? Love saves him. And it's like, oh, give me a break. You know, it's like, come on. Love is going to save the
Cybermen.
I mean, it
works in The Princess Bride, not on Doctor Who.
Yeah, you know, it's like in that episode, one of my favorites, actually, from Russell T. Davies' run, you know, where you have the initiation of the Cybermen in Russell T. Davies' run, which is the name of the episode is like, oh, I'm looking for it, Rise of the Cybermen and Age of Steel. You know, the one character who, you know, a central character gets turned into a Cyberman, and you still see a shred of her humanity in that moment, you know, when you see this tear go down the cheek of the Cyberman. That works for me because she's still a Cyberman, but she retains her humanity to some extent. But this is like, he just gets completely saved from the Cybermen. It's like, what? You know?
Yeah, because never before in any of the Cybermen episodes have we ever had any hint that such a thing was possible.
Right, right.
And really, it turned the Cybermen into the Borg.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it was unfortunate.
To say the least.
By the way,
yes?
Sorry, Speaking of Cybermen, I just have to say one of my very favorite moments in New Who is the Cybermen Dalek trash talk.
Oh, yes, yes. That was beautiful. How did it go? Something about, you know, it will only take one Dalek.
Yeah, the Cybermen are like, they're trash talking between each other, you know, and it's like, it would take this number of Cybermen to, you know, do what, I can't remember the line, but it's, but then, yeah, it would take one Dalek to eliminate all the Cybermen. That's what the Dalek
is. Yeah, it's in
saying,
the series,
you know.
2 finale.
Yeah, series 2 finale. And, I mean, that's just such a great moment because we've seen how formidable the Daleks are in New Who, you know, with that one Chris Eccleston episode where, you know, you can believe it. You can believe that one Dalek could total all the Cybermen, you know, because that's already been established in New Who with the various modifications to the Daleks.
Now, you said you have some favorite episodes, but do you have any favorite companions so far?
Ooh, that's a tougher question. Favorite companions. Well, it's kind of borderline companion, but I really like River Song. Even though she's at the center of a lot of the plot convolutions, I like the character. And I think they do some interesting things with her character. And it's kind of ironic because some of the things I hate the most about Moffat's run are centered, result from all of these River Song convolutions. And yet I love that character. You know, I think she's a really well-realized character, and we get a lot of backstory on her and in sort of interesting ways at various times. And so I really like that character, but it's marginal as to whether she's an actual companion. I don't necessarily like the Donna Noble run as well as I like some of the earlier runs in Russell T. Davies, you know, period. But as a companion, the chemistry that she has with David Tennant is just awesome. You know, David Tennant, and well, because they're friends. And, you know, they just get along really well.
Well, there's
Amy
a great
Rory,
line where the doctor says to Donna, "I just want a mate." And she goes, "No, wait, no, not with me, pal. No, not want to mate. Want a mate, a buddy,
mate.
A pal."
Yeah, exactly. That was so great. You know, and it's like one of the episodes that I have listed as like one of my favorites is actually the first regular Donna Noble episode, even though it's completely stupid. You know, the one with the adipose people.
And the nanny. Yep, the fat baby nanny.
Yeah, that one. I mean, it's just like a completely stupid episode, but there's that scene where they're peeking through the doorways at each other, mouthing, you know? It's like that episode just makes it because of that one scene, you know?
And then the nanny notices them and goes, "Well, do you have anything else to say, or am I interrupting you?"
Yeah.
No, it's great stuff. And, you know, the thing is I think that Davies had a lot more genuine humor, whereas Moffat didn't. And I think that sometimes I felt like Moffat hated the character of the Doctor. And I didn't notice that in the first Moffat episode, but I noticed that in the second one, The Beast Below, where...
Oh, yeah.
I
don't think I noticed any hatred of the Doctor, but I thought the episode was really bad. You know,
yeah, it is very bad, and I was just going to ask you if you noticed that Moffat seemed to almost be putting words were supposed to be the Doctor having a moment of self-loathing that were almost like Moffat attacking the Doctor and telling the audience, "Yeah, this guy's a jackass. We should hate him." Or maybe
can you refresh my memory on that? Because I did not revisit the episode. What I basically did was I just, you know, went through and wrote down titles of episodes that were memorable to me in some way, and that one was just memorable for being bad.
That's
so.
That's
could you
the one
maybe
where
refresh my memory on.
That's
I know
the
about
one
the whale,
where
the space whale.
Yes, that's the one where they end up with the space whale that is carrying UK,
the UK
in through space, because apparently
right.
all the countries of Earth have launched into space on the back of space whales. And
yep.
And they're about to do something to the whale. They're about to brain damage it so that everybody is saved, and the doctor is full of self-loathing, and, you know, and then there's this moment where Amy comes in, and it's supposed to be, but look how nice she's being. And, you know, I think that Moffat was always going for a sort of a deconstruction of the doctor that didn't work, because then after Amy was gone, he brought in Clara, who I liked with the 11th Doctor, but hated with the Capaldi Doctor, because
yeah.
Clara actively started making trouble for the Doctor, and the only, literally the only excuse she or reason she ever gave was, I'm Clara, I'm a woman, I'm great, you're just a man. And, you know, I, you know, just was sitting there watching it going, wait, so now we're supposed to hate the Doctor because he's male, and we're supposed to cheer for his companion who has turned into a bully? This is antithetical to everything the show had ever been about, which was tolerance and love and compassion and understanding, which, you know, the Doctor was not about bullying, and neither were his companions, and suddenly we had a bullying companion.
I think I have a somewhat different take on Clara with Capaldi than that, because I mean, not being male, I didn't pick up on that as clearly as you did. But what I did pick up on, see, I dislike Clara with Capaldi as well, but for different reasons. I really liked her with Matt Smith, and she was like one of my favorite companions with Matt Smith. I liked her because she was clever and she was funny, and, you know, she was basically the same kind of personality that I have, so I could actually really relate to her. But then when she becomes Capaldi's companion, she's filled with all of this just weirdness over the fact that he's changed appearance. You know, no longer is he this young guy, he's this old guy. And, you know, she's getting influenced by her boyfriend who hates the doctor. And she's got all this weird love sickness that she never exhibited before. And it's like he completely did a personality transplant into Clara. I thought it was a real violation of her character. So I really don't like Clara with Capaldi's doctor either, but kind of for maybe somewhat different reasons.
Yeah, no, Capaldi's doctor suffered from a great actor mired in scripts that were well below par, directors that should have known better, and a showrunner that I think had basically shot his creative load in the first 3 years he was running the show.
That sounds fair to me. I guess, you know, for me, one of my big questions, you know, he basically talked in interviews about how, well, now we're going to explore the companion's perspective, blah, 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 with Clara. And I'm like, well, why did you hire this world-class actor to be your doctor if you're more interested in exploring the companion? You know, you've got one of the best British actors alive of his generation in your show right now. Why aren't you focusing more on him? You know, and, you know, she's a fine actress, but at the same time, and, you know, she's done some cool stuff since then. I think she was she in?
She's currently on Victoria, which is very,
okay.
very good.
Yeah, so she's done Victoria, and, you know, she is a very fine actress. But, mm-hmm. you know, it's like, okay, why did you, I mean, it's like the issues that Clara had with the doctor, Rose had also sort of in a different way with Tennant's doctor. Just simply, you know, her pal was the ninth doctor, and then suddenly, you know, the doctor changes. Fortunately, she got a really cute doctor, but you know, she did have issues at first, you know, with the fact that he had changed. And I can understand that with Clara too, especially since there's this, you know, real graphic change. But it's something that could have been dealt with in like 3 or 4 episodes. And, you know, then the companion reconciles to the whole thing, and let's start exploring Capaldi's character, because you've got this amazing actor. I mean, before they started running Capaldi on that show, I went back and I reviewed a whole bunch of clips that the BBC put out to promote Capaldi based upon previous performances. And some of the scenes that they put out there were just stellar. I mean, just amazing performances. This guy can really, really act, and you know, he doesn't have the training. It's all learned on the job. But he's just a terrific actor, and they just wasted him.
Mm-hmm.
So,
they did.
You know, I'm glad that I'm sorry, I forget her name, the actress who played Clara. But
gosh,
I'm really glad.
I'm embarrassed to forget her name as well.
But, you know, I'm glad that she got a career lift out of it, because she is a good actress, and she, you know, earned
Jenna Coleman.
She earned the stuff she's doing now. But, you know, it's like for Capaldi, it was, I know he always wanted to play the doctor, but it's like sad that his doctor didn't get better support from the writing.
Mm-hmm. You know, and some people had problems with the stuff with the doctor being interested in, like, the guitar and the sonic shades. I actually thought that was a riot.
I loved his guitar playing. And, you know, I mean, Capaldi was in a punk band when he was young, so why not? Why not incorporate that element of his personality into the character?
Right, right. I mean, you know, they let John Pertwee have Bessie. they let Hartnell do his little mutterings and try to work his illness into the show as the doctor just being extra quirky.
Yeah.
But I do want to talk really quickly about your favorite episodes. Do you have an actual like top 5 or top 10 list ready then?
Oh gosh. You know, it's
or is
really
it just
hard.
General favorites.
It's like massive. My list is massive of episodes that I love, but you know, I could, like, from the Russell T. Davies period.
How about this? I'll make it easy on you.
Okay.
Choose one favorite episode of each Doctor from this era.
Oh, okay. From each Doctor. Okay. Chris Eccleston. Oh, I'm looking at my list for Chris Eccleston, and it's like, how do I choose between these three? But because I have Dalek, Father's Day, and The Empty Child, Dr. Dances listed, but I'm going to choose.
Those are mine.
Those are yours?
Those are mine as well.
Yeah, I'm going to choose Dalek because it's the reintroduction of the Daleks, which is the iconic, you know, the iconic monster for the series. It's the first real monster of the series. I mean, it was the second serial they ever did. And it's a truly terrifying episode. And it's the first episode that you can really start to see, for me at least, the true potential of this series, of this new, you know, envisioning of Doctor Who.
Mm-hmm.
So even though I think Father's Day is amazing, and so is The Empty Child and The Doctor Dances, which is, I believe, Moffat's first writing, you know, turn in Doctor Who. I would say that's the episode I would pick simply because it relaunched the villain, unfortunately, or relaunched the monster. Unfortunately, subsequent developments did not live up to Dalek, but, you know, I think that was a great moment in Chris Eccleston's run. David Tennant.
By far, it's the best episode of that series, and I still think that on balance, Eccleston's season may be the most consistent series of New Who.
I would probably agree with that statement. The only reason that Eccleston is probably not, you know, going to make it to my favorite Doctor is simply because he had such a short run. And, you know, I mean, he's definitely great, though. I mean, what he accomplished is really significant because he relaunched the character in a way that could relate to a new audience. And it was just masterful. And I'm sorry that he was going through so much pain at the time that, you know, it was not a positive experience for him and that he had to, you know, bow out when he did. But, you know, that's unfortunate. I really would have loved to have seen more of him as the Doctor.
No, I thought he did really well with the time that he was on the show and the fact that, you know, people watch it and they say, oh, he must have been the Doctor for a long time. I was like, nope, 13 episodes. And they're like, what?
Yeah,
13
episodes.
All he did?
It. Yeah, yeah. But without him, there would be no New Who.
No.
You know.
Nope. Moving on to Tennant. What's your favorite Tennant episode?
Oh, gosh, that's so hard. it comes down to, well, okay, not counting the End of Time special, which is probably my very favorite, it's hard to decide between Human Nature, Family of Blood, and Silence in the Library, Forest of the Dead. I'm still, they're both so good, but I'm still going to have to go for Human Nature, Family of Blood.
I think it's got a little more emotional truth in it.
Yeah. And that's the moment when you see, you know, you see the wrath of the Time Lord, you know, as I think, what's the name of the actor who played Viserys, who was the lead role in that? Anyway, that actor, who incidentally is like a great-great-grandson of Charles Dickens.
Charles
I don't
Dickens.
Know if you know that. Yeah,
yep.
Yeah.
What's his name? Lloyd?
Yeah, Harry Lloyd, I think is his name. He was the actor who gave the narration there, and it's just a wonderful narration. But, you know, when I think he refers to it as the wrath of the Time Lord, and that ending is just so spectacular. You know, the things that he did to ensure that they would never return to, you know, cause this much pain for people again. That was just I loved that two-parter, and that was just so good. That was so good, you know. And, I mean, there's a bunch of episodes from that run that I love. I mean, I love Blink, too, you know, but that's another one that's just mostly clever, whereas Human Nature, Family of Blood, as you say, has a lot of truth to it, a lot of human truth to it. And, you know, anyway, that's the one I'm going for.
So what about Matt Smith?
Okay, let me look at Matt. You know, there's a bunch of stuff that I really like with Matt. And I do like that six-season plot craziness. I really do love that. But in terms of actual episodes, I mean, I love his first Christmas special, A Christmas Carol. But my favorite regular episode is probably Vincent and the Doctor.
Vincent and the Doctor is beautiful. I really, really love it. I'm also quite fond of the Crimson Horror episode.
Uh-huh, yeah.
But
is that the
I
one
think that...
Mm-hmm. It is... Oh, gosh. I keep forgetting everybody's names, you know? But the Crimson Horror is that the one with Emma Peel?
Yes. Yes, it's the one with Diane Rigg in it. And,
yeah, Diane Rigg. Yeah.
And but I think that those two episodes are probably my favorites. I mean, I have a lot of love for The Doctor's Wife. I had a lot of fun with other episodes. But I think
I enjoyed Let's Kill Hitler, for goodness sake, you know.
Well, I have issues with that one on many levels. Not the least of which is that if I want to actually see them kill Hitler, if you're going to call it Let's Kill Hitler, let's actually go kill Hitler. But they're not going to do that.
I just thought it was funny, you know, that was actually a line in the episode. You know, so, you know, hey, let's kill Hitler. But, yeah, I kind of liked that.
But I do have to say that I think that my favorite Matt Smith episode, period, is going to be The Day of the Doctor. I just really love that episode. Although I think the best thing to come out of the 50th anniversary might be An Adventure in Space and Time.
Which
That's
one was
that?
That's
the TV movie about the creation of Doctor Who with
David
Bradley as William Hartnell.
Oh, yeah. David Bradley was wonderful as William Hartnell. That was awesome. In fact, that was my sister's introduction to Doctor Who. I kept trying to convince my sister to watch Doctor Who, and, you know, she's a science fiction geek from way back, and she was resistant because she thought that Doctor Who was kind of silly and, you know, all of that.
Oh,
and
it is.
I said, it is. But I convinced her, you know, because of the 50th anniversary, I convinced her to watch The Adventure in Space and Time and The Day of the Doctor. And she immediately fell in love with Doctor Who and, you know, started watching all the new Who. And then she started watching the original series and started watching all those Hartnell episodes. It was just really kind of funny. But, yeah, that was her introduction to Doctor Who. But I have to say, okay, after The Day of the Doctor is one of the best episodes in New Who, period. I was just referring to Vincent and the Doctor as a regular, you know, episode of the series. So that was like series 5, and it was like one of the great episodes of that. But yeah, The Day of the Doctor is just, it's like Stephen Moffat actually really rose to the occasion and wrote an amazing, amazing episode that, you know, really, I think it will stand the test of time. I think it's going to go down as one of the great Doctor Who episodes.
Yeah, and, you know, and of course, in Vincent and the Doctor, he brought in Richard Curtis, who, you know, people might know him now for things like Four Weddings and a Funeral or Notting Hill, but people forget he started out on television, and he, along with Rowan Atkinson, are the brains behind Blackadder.
Yeah.
But
That was such a beautiful episode.
Oh, it was. But do you have a favorite episode from Whitaker's one season?
We haven't done Capaldi yet.
Well, I want to get into Capaldi, but we're going to jump ahead to Whitaker. Do you have a Whitaker episode yet?
Yeah, I do so far, but gosh, it's really hard to choose between the two episodes that I would single out. And they were like back-to-back, but they're not a two-parter. And for me, it was like Demons of the Punjab and Kerblam.
I didn't like Kerblam, but I love Demons of the Punjab, and that is my top episode that season.
You know what I found interesting, though, is in reading – you know, my social media, because I have a lot of friends from the UK in my social media because I was on that, you know, British board for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like my UK friends, their favorite episode was Rosa. And, you know, a lot of Brits were somewhat dismissive of Demons of the Punjab, whereas I think it's maybe a bit reversed for Americans. You know, for me, Rosa was a fine episode, but it was a little familiar, you know, whereas Demons of the Punjab was putting an interesting take on something that I kind of only vaguely knew about. And I think it's kind of the opposite for my friends in the UK. You know, it's like they know about Rosa, but they intimately know, you know, the partition of India. and Pakistan. So, you know, I think maybe this familiarity factor plays in a little bit on those two episodes as to which side of the pond prefers which episode. But my favorite was definitely Demons of the Punjab.
Yeah, I would say I noticed similar, and I think, you know, that for me, I was somewhat familiar with the partition. You know, of course, I've studied the end of British rule in India, and the birth of Pakistan, and I've seen documentaries and movies depicting it. There's, of course, The Jewel in the Crown, which one of the final sequences in that miniseries is a long train ride in which a couple of characters get killed because of what they are during the partition, the violence that broke out during the partition, and quite moving stuff. But I liked Demons of the Punjab because I think it had some really good character development for everyone. But I really, really love the dynamic. And speaking of that, that's one thing that I think really did work for me during Whitaker's season. I'm not sure how well we got to know the 13th Doctor.
Mm-hmm.
Or technically,
yeah, I
technically,
would agree.
Technically the 14th, if we want to, but we'll get into that later.
Yeah. the 13th and a half Doctor, or the 14th
yes.
Doctor, or whatever
yes.
number we want to assign.
But,
yeah.
You know, we have this great set of companions, especially the man and his stepson, and that's just a beautiful relationship that unfolds over those, what was it, 10 episodes we got?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Was it only 10? Yeah, I guess it was.
Yeah, they keep cutting our episodes.
But, you know, I also like Yasmin. So, you know, Yasmin.
Oh, yeah, she's a great character. I don't care what people say. But that gave you an understanding of where she's coming from culturally.
Yeah, and it was, I thought that was just such a, that was a great episode. That was just wonderful, I thought. And I also loved the fact that the aliens that we initially assume are doing horrible things are actually not, you know, that they're actually there to honor the forgotten dead. And, I mean, I thought that was a beautiful take on it. One of the things I like very much about Jodie Whittaker's season, in terms of the writing, is that it's done a lot more to explore human monstrosity rather than these external monsters so much. It's like the monster that's inside the human heart. And
look at the episode with Chris Noth in it as an odious businessman / politician.
Yeah, can you refresh my memory on that one? I think
forget the name
it's
of
the
episode
one.
Right now,
yeah,
which I'm very embarrassed. But
it's the Arachnids of London, I think, yeah.
Yes, it was the one with the spiders. And, you know, I think they actually really missed a beat there. They could have turned the trick of connecting it to the spiders from Planet of Spiders.
You know, the thing that I liked that episode until the end, it's like there was like a missing 5 minutes or something, you know, where something happened and it's like, what? You know, it's like there's this gap in terms of the resolution. So the episode wasn't as perfect as it could have been, but, you know, the realization of that businessman character I thought was very good, you know. And
yes.
Yeah. And it also kind of fits in to some extent with the businessman character that, you know, we initially see in the Dalek episode all the way back in, you know, Chris Eccleston's period.
Mm-hmm.
Although this
both
one's
of
more
them
exaggerated.
Were obnoxious Americans.
Yeah, both were obnoxious Americans. And I don't remember all the details of the arachnids one. I know the guy in Utah was like collecting all sorts of stuff, but you know, and he collected
yeah, and he claimed to own the internet.
Yeah. But I'm glad that not all Americans are presented as odious.
No. Now let's go back to Capaldi. So what is your favorite Capaldi episode?
I don't know if this is going to be popular, but I actually like I think it's called Heaven Sent. It's the one where he's stuck in that box for a billion years.
That's the best episode Capaldi ever did.
Yeah, that's my favorite. And, you know, my husband hated it, but, you know, I've played enough Myst and games like that to, you know, know when I'm looking at a puzzle. And, you know, to me it was like playing a puzzle game. And I loved it. I mean, I just really, really loved everything about it. And aside from that, I really liked Flatline, which I thought was amazingly inventive.
You know, that's the thing. There were these great ideas in especially Series 9, which I think was Capaldi's best series.
Yeah, I would agree.
Just sometimes they went somewhere and sometimes they didn't. A Shoulder, for instance, or Me, as she liked to be called, was an interesting concept that, I'm going to be honest, I think Maisie Williams was miscast. And I think that Moffitt, once again, got afraid of doing nuance and just went with angry young woman who isn't really all that young anymore. And it does a disservice to women. It does a disservice to the respect that he should have had for the audience's intelligence. And it really did Maisie Williams, who is a decent actress, no good, because that is not a character I would ever want to see again.
Now, I had a different take on it. You want to hear mine?
Sure.
I actually liked her initial two-parter. I did not like her returns. I did not like her recurring character aspect. But
yeah, that's
the
part that really bugged the hell out of me.
Yeah, it was the recurring aspect when she, returns in later iterations. But the initial two-parter I really liked, and here's why. in the first one, you know, I liked the Viking stuff. You know, I thought that was really kind of fun and cool until her character, you know, basically gets killed. And then, you know, she gets brought back, but it's permanent. And it's immortality, and it's something she's not capable of dealing with. And I thought that the second episode, even though it had flaws, I thought that it did a good job of illustrating the despair of her condition, the despair of having to live all of these lives and have everybody die on her. And that's where the anger is coming from. And that scene where she's, you know, you see he's reading her diaries, and that scene where you're envisioning what her experience was, everybody, her children, all of her children died of the plague. And, I mean, for me, that was really heart-wrenching, and I thought it was a wonderful character development for that character. And that was actually the moment when I saw Maisie Williams as an adult actress for the first time. Now, do not like what they did subsequently with the character, so I'm on board with you about that, but I actually did like that initial two-parter. And
well, you
I
know,
thought
the thing that is that the initial two-parter hinted at Moffitt being capable of empathy as a writer. But I'm just going to be completely honest here and say that I think that Moffitt has absolutely no empathy as a writer, that he is completely as smug and glib as he comes across, and that his stories don't resonate emotionally because there is no depth to his writing on an emotional level, because he himself is incapable of feeling the way a writer needs to feel in order to write that sort of material. But that may just be me. I may also just be very angry at Moffitt for continually attacking, I don't know, the Doctor as a character, the companions as people, and just basically taking a show that I once loved, and for a few years there having one of my favorite actors of the last 20 years, and reducing his time on the show to cameos by Peter Capaldi as the Doctor in the Clara Oswald show.
Yeah, I understand. Yeah. I'm not as angry at Moffitt on a personal level. I don't know whether he's capable of empathy, but I do know that he seems. Here's my take on Capaldi. I mean, not Capaldi, on Moffitt. My take on Moffitt, and I think that this is just borne out by massive amounts of plot evidence, is that Moffitt is so terrified of death that he's willing to convolute every single plot so that no major character can ever truly die. And that robs the show of its emotional resonance. I mean, he just does the weirdest stuff to make sure nobody ever dies. And I think that's one of his major flaws. And I think maybe some of this crazy plot stuff is there because he's just, I don't know, he can't come to conclusions because conclusions are another type of death. But it's I don't know what it is with Moffitt. I just see it as essentially his plots are like an attempt to escape the inevitable, and that's what robs for me. It's like, oh, it's another Moffitt story in which, you know, somebody dies and then doesn't. You know, another Moffitt story in which somebody dies and then doesn't. It's like a repeated pattern. It wouldn't be too bad if he did it occasionally. I mean, we love it when, you know, they do that sort of thing in moderation in various, you know, genre shows that we love. But if you do it like all the time, it just becomes ridiculous because that's not life as we know it. And the show needs to be true in some ways to life as we know it, to life is actually lived. And so I did think that it was really cool what he did initially with Maisie to show the despair of immortality without, you know, the Doctor is immortal too. I mean, he can choose to die. Her character can't even choose to die. And, you know, he at least is part of a race that's common with, you know, I mean, that's something, but she has no, there's no background for that with human beings. You know, I mean, he's a Time Lord. He has an infinite number of regenerate, well, not infinite, but the Time Lords can grant him an infinite number now, as we know, but he has a large number of potential regenerations. He can live for a very, 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 very long time. But, you know, me or Ashilda or whatever we want to call her, you know, that's not what humans do. And it's an impossible situation for her. And I think that, yeah, it's more the recurring character that bothers me than those first two episodes. And I think you're right. He did hint at being able to experience that empathy, but then he killed it, you know, with subsequent developments in that character. And also Clara, whom he wouldn't let die. You know?
Mm-hmm. And with Bill.
Yeah.
And with Amy and Rory, whom, you know, of course, they died in the past, but they lived a life, which, you know, that I could live with because we know how the Weeping Angels work. And it was a bittersweet ending, but it worked. And, you know, Moffitt always described his time on Who as dark fairy tales, particularly with Smith. And I could see where he was going with that, with Smith, especially the first series. But later on, no. Later on, it's like he was trying to audition for Buffy the Vampire Slayer, and I don't think that Buffy that was the right way to go. And before anybody thinks I'm slagging Buffy the Vampire Slayer, I'm not. I'm a fan of the show. It's one of my top 100 shows. But Doctor Who and Buffy are distinctly separate entities, and you shouldn't try to make one show the other show because you'll lose what makes each unique.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, Doctor Who has always thrived on the vulnerability of the Doctor in some ways. And,
yeah.
You know, the Doctor, I mean, it goes back to, as you said earlier, Hartnell, because, you know, they're trying to work his physical problems. It was a neurological illness, was it?
I believe it was some sort of, was it arterial sclerosis? It was something that caused a hardening of the veins and therefore a lack of, I believe it was arterial sclerosis. I'd have to look it up. But he eventually just, he could work, but regular work like Doctor Who became impossible for him to do because of memory issues due to blood circulation problems.
That's so unfortunate. And, you know, it's like he launched the show, he got a few years in, but then he had to, you know, but it created the whole idea of regeneration because they needed to keep the show going. But, yeah, I mean, that character, sorry to go back to classic Who, but I think it's relevant to new Who. You know, the thing that Hartnell accomplished was, you know, he starts off as this very, very, very alien entity who doesn't really have a lot of compassion. But as he gets to know humans better, he develops that compassion. And by the end of his run, he has these wonderful relationships with his companions. And, you know, he's grown to love and respect the people that he travels with. And that's something that ends up carrying through with the other doctors. And, you know, so you kind of always have to have that that compassion element in the doctor. It's like, yeah, sure, Capaldi's doctor can give a speech about compassion.
But did he show it very often?
Yeah, yeah.
And his companions, certainly, Clara never showed it once Capaldi was the doctor.
Yeah, that really troubled me about her character because I really liked her before, and suddenly I agree with you, by the way, that she does become a bully, but I think it's partly instigated by Danny Pink. That
who was
an
awful, awful, awful character on so
horrible
many
character
levels. You know, they have their first African descended companion since Mickey, or regular recurring character since Mickey and Martha. And what do? They make him hate the doctor. They turn him into an overly aggressive bully who controls his girlfriend, who is jealous, who...
Yeah, jealous of the doctor, for goodness sakes.
Yeah, who is a teacher, but what does he teach? Phys ed. You know, we could go into it, and I don't want to get too politically correct, but there are some social issues with the depiction of Danny Pink.
I'm not going
to
disagree.
In addition to the fact that the character is just boring.
Yeah, the character's boring, and he's a jerk, you know? I did not like that. First of all, I didn't see Clara, you know, the Clara that I knew from the Matt Smith years. I didn't see her falling for a character like him. And then she does. And it's just weird. And I can understand maybe somewhat the emotional bounce that she's getting here because, you know, this doctor that she knew as Matt Smith has completely altered his personality, his physical appearance has entirely changed. But going over to somebody like Danny Pink, you know, she's a woman who likes cerebral things. She's really a pretty cerebral character and a very clever character. And Danny Pink's just not. And so I don't really see her as falling for that guy. And then for letting him control her in the way that he does and controlling her perception of the doctor, it's like it's really weird. I mean, she's having issues with the doctor anyway because he's changed. But then she buys into his viewpoint of the doctor, and it's just weird. It's like Clara suddenly doesn't have a mind of her own, which she always has had before.
And maybe it's just me getting the hair up my ass, but I think that Moffat was almost trying to train the audience to hate the doctor in the way that Danny hated the doctor, in order to make Clara, who was now the center of the show, more appealing. He was sacrificing the doctor on the altar of Clara and Danny. First off, Danny's a character we didn't know and we didn't care about. Clara was somebody who we'd begun to enjoy, or maybe even had fallen for with Matt Smith, and then immediately got a personality transplant into somebody we didn't know or want to know.
Yeah.
And there's much of the Capaldi era, especially that eighth season, that feels very forced.
Yeah, that season really... You know, what's funny, though, is that I think the first Danny Pink, it wasn't the first Danny Pink episode, but it was the astronaut thing, his ancestor or whatever, listen, that episode.
Yeah.
I really liked that episode. So it's like I was actually kind of predisposed to, you know, think Danny Pink was an okay guy because I really liked Listen. I thought that was a great episode. And then, you know, the series just, it just messed with him and it messed with Clara. And, you know, by the time we get to Listen, which is, I think, the fourth episode of the series, or maybe the next episode, within those first four or five episodes, Clara should resolve her issue with the doctor, you know, and move on and just realize that, you know, yes, the doctor's changed. Or maybe she should go, you know, be somebody else's companion and not bother with the doctor anymore. But, you know, it should resolve itself in those first four or five episodes rather than drag it on through the entire season and make it such an issue that nobody really wants.
Right. Right. That's absolutely what happened. Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Yeah. And I know that I read some people enjoying the Clara stuff, but I'm like, no, man. I mean, this isn't my Clara. This isn't the Clara that I remember from, you know, the Matt Smith era.
I just thought it
was a violation of her character, you know, and they established a good character and then they destroyed it.
Yeah, and we both have backgrounds in history and literature, so, you know, consistency in character and sacrificing character to plot contrivances really hits both of us someplace special.
Yes,
I think.
It does. It does, yeah. I remember having dinner table conversations about Clara, you know, with my husband. I think we both were on the same page with that. We both hated Danny Pink. We both, you know, thought that Clara was not Clara. And, it would have been contrived, but it would have made more sense if we discovered that Clara really wasn't Clara, you know, if something had taken over her brain or something. But, you know, that's, and I know that would have been incredibly contrived and cliched, but it would have made more sense.
Well, it worked for Amy when we found out that she was a, when we found out that the Amy we'd seen for a few episodes had been Flesh.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that did work.
But, you know,
he knew how to write for Amy and Rory, I think.
Yeah, he did. But I'm going to say, I think that that crew, the Smith era, just had a genuine bond that I don't think ever came across. Now, I don't care how close Capaldi and Coleman were off screen, but it never showed on the series itself, whereas, you know, the Smith era, we really got a sense of how much these people cared for each other, and it was obvious that the affection they felt off screen was being shown on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it was a good run.
Yes. Yes, it was.
Yeah. There was a lot of now, really good stuff in that period.
Mm-hmm. Oh, there was. Now, I want to talk about something that we haven't talked about yet. Now, you know, there have been many incarnations of this character. Back during the War Games, which was the final Patrick Troughton episode, there was a character that some argue was this character. Others say it wasn't. I tend to think that it was kind of a dry run for this type of a character. And the character is, of course, the Master. And
yes,
we first had Richard Delgado as the Master. Then we had a few people that played a decaying, burnt, warped version of the Master under very heavy makeup and robes. And then we had the Anthony Ainley version during the 80s. And then we were reintroduced to the Master in the third series of the current run of Doctor Who. And I'll let you speak about that, because we've spoken how much you enjoyed that. So tell the audience what you thought of the reintroduction of the Master.
Okay. Well, first of all, I kind of want to go back just a little bit to Richard Delgado, because he was actually introduced as the Master because he was such a close friend of John Pertwee's. And, you know, John Pertwee wanted his friend in the show, and so he became his nemesis, right? But that was wonderful, but of course, you know, Richard Delgado died suddenly in an accident. And they had to do other things with the character. But for me, okay, my first experience with the Master was in the three-part episode that ends Series 3. And the first part of that, it's like you've got this really seemingly kindly doctor, and he's played by Derek Jacobi or Jacobi or Jacobi or however his name is pronounced. Jacobi. Okay. So he's played by Derek Jacobi, and, you know, who's just a world-class, you know, actor, Shakespearean and everything else.
Yeah, one of the all-time
great British actors. Yeah, one of the all-time great British actors. So, you know, he's playing this kindly doctor and all of this, and then at the end of the episode, we discover that he's got this secret that he doesn't even know, because which is something that's been established in an earlier episode through this mechanism that, you know, the timepiece thing. Huh? What was it called? Yeah, the memory fob.
It was like a memory fob, basically.
Yeah, it was a memory fob. But he doesn't even know who he really is. You know, he thinks he's human and all of this other stuff. But then something happens and, you know, it's revealed to him who he is, and he's like transformed immediately into the Master. And it's like this incredible reveal moment. And for me, it's like I was unacquainted with the character. Okay, I didn't know the character, but I can imagine that heads were exploding all across the UK when this character was introduced, and it was Derek Jacobi transforming into the Master. And, I mean, not a physical transformation yet, but it was a, you know, a personality transformation, and he says, "My name is the Master," or some line like that. And you're just like, you gasp. Even if you don't know who the Master is, you know this is significant, you know? And that was,
yeah,
that was my
experience.
Yeah,
I believe the actual line is, "That is not my name."
Yeah.
"Okay, then who are you?" He takes a step, M, another step, the Master. And he says it in a way that reminds me very much of Delgado.
Okay. Yeah, and I'm sure that he studied Delgado's performances, because he's such a good actor. He would have done that. But it's like that's such an amazing moment. And, you know, even for somebody like me who was unacquainted with the character, I knew immediately that this was significant. You know, just by the way he said it, it's like, oh, this must be a recurring character. This must be an important character. Wow,
yeah.
This is really cool. You know, and then, of course, he does end up having a regeneration into John Sim, who takes the master in a completely different direction. I find John Sim's master very, very entertaining, very fun. And I find Michelle Gomez's Missy also very entertaining. But, you know, they don't have that sort of gravitas of Derek Jacobi or Richard Delgado, you know, Richard Delgado was always like impeccably dressed. John Sim, you know, it's like he's out there in his gym wear sometimes, you know, but it's just such a great character. And I know that after that one moment and after that three-parter, every time the master reappeared, of course, you know, I was very excited, you know, just to see the master again. And it made me go back into the old, you know, the classic series and watch the original master episode and see where this character originated, where he came from, and to kind of read up on him, because that's the kind of impact that the character had on me. And, you know, Derek Jacobi, just in that one episode, you know, did that. And then John Sim took it and ran with it and took the master into the next generation. But it was just a wonderful, I thought it was a wonderful way that they did it. And it's, yeah, and also just the way that they linked it to that previous episode, which is in Human Nature, Family of Blood, right? The memory fob?
Yes.
Hello?
Yes, that would be that. That is the episode.
Yeah, so you have that as well, you know, and so it links back to probably the best episode of the Martha Jones companion era, and
No, and I have to say, I think Martha, in some ways, was my favorite of the Davies companions.
Yeah, I really liked Martha a lot. By the way, I have to put in one word for another character who was not a full-time companion by any means, but and the episode's not one of my favorite episodes, but it has some of my favorite stuff in it, and that's the school reunion episode, which reintroduced Sarah Jane Smith, who was one of Tom Baker's companions, correct?
Yep. Well, she started out as a Pertwee companion and then became a Baker companion.
Right. So, okay, so she was a Pertwee and then Baker. And I've only seen like one or two of her serials with Baker. Haven't seen anything of her with Pertwee, but I love Pertwee's doctor. And I think that was one of Capaldi's favorite doctors as well. He really loved Pertwee's doctor. But,
They introduced the Santarans with, along with Sarah Jane.
Right, yeah. And was it the Santarans? I thought it was those. Anyway, Sarah, what was remarkable to me about that particular episode wasn't the writing so much as the interaction between David Tennant and I can't remember the actress's name.
And I meant the original Sarah Jane. Sorry for the confusion there. I meant that in the original run of the show, when they created Sarah Jane and introduced her.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, yeah. But in the episode School Reunion, what I find remarkable is that David Tennant, you know, who this is like his third or fourth episode, I think. David Tennant has been a Doctor Who fan since he's a little boy. It's how he got into acting. It's what motivated him to become an actor. And here he is in like his fourth episode getting to interact with a companion from the classic Who era that motivated him to become an actor. And what's wonderful about it is that moment when he recognizes her, you know, not David, but when the doctor recognizes Sarah Jane, the enthusiasm in those lines and the enthusiasm with every single interaction he has with her not only shows the doctor's affection for Sarah Jane, but it also just, it's like, David Tennant is such a fanboy, and it just bleeds through the screen, and it's beautiful. It's just
it absolutely
so
does.
Beautiful.
And it constantly did. There was a joy to his performance that, you know, as much as I love Capaldi, I don't think that his Doctor had a lot of joy.
No, neither do I. And Capaldi's the same as Tennant in terms of his motivation to want to be an actor. You know, he was a big Doctor Who fan as well. But, yeah, his
mm-hmm.
Doctor, he took it in a darker direction. And I don't think it was only Moffat. I think that there was some consultation about how they wanted to do this Doctor. So, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it was definitely partly, you know. Plus, you know, they kind of needed a counterbalance because Matt Smith had kind of picked up on some aspects of Tennant's Doctor. You know, he was a little hyper-caffeinated, to say the least. And I think they wanted to take Capaldi's Doctor in a different direction just to have a counterbalance. But, you know, you're right. There wasn't a lot of joy. And Tennant was always just, yeah, even though he could be very emo as well, you know, there was a real joy in his performance.
You know, speaking of Smith being hyper-caffeinated, that was Smith himself. You know, the two-parter that ends Series 5 where, you know, the Pandorica opens, that
mm-hmm.
that episode.
Yeah. Yeah, I know the episode.
Where the Doctor is in the area below Stonehenge, and he's got a torch in his hand. And by a torch, I mean an actual lit torch.
Right, yeah.
Moffat said in an interview in Doctor Who magazine, "We were shooting the finale, and I looked over and saw Matt with a flaming torch in his hand. And I saw our set, and I thought, oh, no, that's Matt. This is our set. That's a flaming torch. That's Matt on our set with a flaming torch. Oh, what have I written?"
That's actually really funny.
Mm-hmm.
I had not seen that. That's a really funny line, and I can totally imagine that. Yeah.
But
yeah,
you know,
I don't want to completely
slag Moffat, but I just have such disgust with the Capaldi era that it sometimes shadows or colors the earlier stuff that I quite enjoyed.
Yeah, I my thing is that here's my issue with Moffat. If I look at all the episodes that I wrote down for the Russell T. Davies era, you know, as the ones that I really love, I mean, four of them, and I mean, that includes the two-parters, okay, so a full four of them are actually, you know, or five actually, are actually, you know, like, they're Moffat. Four or five of them are Moffat. And he was a really, really good writer, you know, for somebody else, for somebody else's mm-hmm. conception of the Doctor. What became a problem was him being the showrunner, you know, where he doesn't have anybody to check his worst impulses. And, you know, so it's like he's now the showrunner. He's pretty much allowed free rein. And so all of his impulses for putting plot over character kind of come to the fore. And that was unfortunate. And by the time you get to Capaldi, it's like it's become extreme, you know, so extreme that in the last season, it's like there's right really no character left. It's just all plot contrivances. So it's, you know, I just found it a real, it's like he starts out okay and then it gets more extreme as it goes. And I think part of that is that he was trying to juggle all those earlier balls and trying to make them work somehow, but they never could work, you know, because they never made sense in the first place. But you could kind of pull some sleight of hand trying to convince people that they worked plot-wise.
Yeah.
You know, So, like, sixth season doesn't really make sense, but that's okay because we're having fun, you know? But then by the later seasons, you know, it's just like it keeps building and building and building and becoming more and more impossible. And I just think it started collapsing under its own weight. You know, it's like I couldn't even keep track anymore of what was happening. You know, it's
pretty
like
much.
You'd have to have a flow chart, and I don't think the flow chart would have even – it would have been like one of those QAnon flow charts. You know, have you ever seen that? Where,
yes.
You know, QAnon, where they work in like the Illuminati and all that other kind of stuff. That's kind of like what a Stephen Moffat plot flow chart would look like.
Yep.
You know.
Yeah, you know that. I'm not sure what that says when you say that it would take a conspiracy theorist flowchart to explain Moffat, and maybe even then end up confused.
I think you would end up confused, you know, because it really doesn't make sense. You know, it just. He's doubling time back on itself and going – it's in ways that become – I mean, of course, obviously, all of this is impossible, but in ways that don't even make sense within any framework, you know, that I can think of, unless you're dealing with, I don't know, some conception of time. Maybe it's like the fifth dimension, you know. Maybe we got to go back to A Wrinkle in Time and get that fifth dimension in here to make it all make sense.
Oh, Doctor Who is written by Ursula K. Le Guin. Ah, what could be? What could have been? So is there anything overall? There's what I want to ask. A lot of, and we're going to wrap this up pretty soon, but... A lot of Doctor Who fans love both runs of the show. Some of them obviously prefer one to the other. And I probably do think that overall I have had, you know, it's easier to get attached to the newer stuff in some ways. But what to you separates the current run from the old run, aside from, you know, the format and technical advances?
Well, I would say, well, acting style, I think, is a big one. You have definitely in the older Who, you have kind of coming more from the British stage tradition, you know, with Hartnell and Troughton and Pertwee and all of those guys, really. Colin Smith, that's his last name, isn't it? Is it Smith? Colin Baker. Yeah, Colin Baker. I only have seen one of his episodes, and it was not very well written, but I saw a fan, I saw him at a convention, a clip of him at a convention reading one of Matt Smith's speeches. It was the speech from The Rings of the Cotton, which is a really fabulous speech. I'm not sure it makes sense, but it's fabulous words. And they gave it to him as a cold read, you know, and they did this with all the doctors at their panels. They just gave them all these cold read things from Matt Smith's era. And Colin Baker, I mean, he had me in shivers. He was so beautiful. It was like he's cold reading this Matt Smith speech and making it his own, and it was so beautifully done. But it was very stagey. I mean, it was very much, you know, British stage tradition acting.
Yep.
And, you know, Matt read it in a very different way, of course. But I loved it. That's one of the key things that I think is different between the doctors, is that the newer doctors have a different style of acting that's based more in media than stage. They have more prior experience in media And they also have stage experience, so because they're British, so especially, you know, David and Christopher, they have a lot of stage background. I'm not sure Capaldi has much stage. I think he's mostly, you know, media. But
he has some stage, and don't ever forget, you know, he also has his Oscar for his short film about Kafka.
Yes, I know about that. Yeah, he does have that too. But
have you seen that short film?
I haven't seen it. I haven't seen it, but I know about it. And
I believe YouTube may still have it. It's well worth hunting down.
YouTube probably does have it. Okay, yeah, YouTube probably does have it because YouTube would tend to have something like that, a significant artifact by a major figure. Yeah, so that would probably be, yeah, I could look that up. That sounds interesting. But I would say that the style of acting is very different between the two series. The style of writing, not just in terms of format, but I would say that there's, you know, most of my doctors that I've seen actually are the first three doctors of the Classic Who. So for Classic Who, I haven't seen a lot of the later doctors. I have seen some fifth doctor and some fourth doctor, but mostly I concentrated on the first three. And, you know, it's like they tended, it's not just the format, but they tended to have a beginning, middle, and end, and, you know, in the serial. And in New Who, especially with Moffat, you could have things that carried on for five seasons. You know, you would have an initial point, and you would get something of a semi-resolution at the end, but then it would continue on, and then you would have new elements added in. So there was that writing element as well, in which, you know, things had to have this sort of overarching plan, which is like, it's like you have, it's like the inspiration of J. Michael Straczynski gone berserk, at least with Moffat, you know, not so much with Russell T. Davies, where he does have a conclusion that's foreordained for his finales, but, you know, and there's some hint of where it's going, you know, with the bad wolf thing and all of that stuff. So you do have hints in Davies, but it's not like forced on the audience as much as it is with Moffat. And with Moffat, it all goes berserk.
I think that Davies is a much more disciplined dramatist. And have you seen, speaking of Davies, have you, just out of curiosity, have you seen his latest series, Years and Years?
No, I haven't. But I did see Torchwood.
Yes, and we have not mentioned that. So before we go, we have to discuss Torchwood, which, for those who don't know, Doctor Who had a spinoff centered around a character that somehow we've not mentioned yet, and now I guess we have to mention him. Captain Jack Harkness, who was an apparently immortal being because of something that happens involving the Time Vortex and the Daleks and Rose. And eventually he goes on to take over part of an organization that is called Torchwood, that does these supernatural and extraterrestrial, I don't want to say investigations, but containments.
Yeah, yeah, that would be a better term. An investigation
and,
is part of the containment.
Yeah. And there were two regular series of Torchwood, followed by two miniseries. The fourth miniseries, which was a co-production with Starz called Miracle Day, is one of the most miserable pieces of shit I've ever seen anywhere. And everyone involved with it should probably just say, I'm sorry, and I'll forgive them. However, I love, love, love Children of Earth because it is so dark and contained and resonant. But there are episodes of Torchwood that I enjoyed. So real, real quick, What's your take on Torchwood?
Well, for starters, I think Children of Earth is a must-see for anybody who's interested in the Whovian universe at all. You know, it is beyond brilliant. I mean, I just cannot praise it enough. It's possibly better than any episode of New Who. It is so good. And it's, wow, it's just great. Torchwood itself.
And let me interrupt here. And don't forget, Peter Capaldi is in Torchwood.
Yes, Peter Capaldi is in Children of Earth, and he plays a memorable character who has a horrible decision to make. And anyway, I don't want to go further into it because that's a must-see. I mean, Children of Earth is a multi-parter. I think it's five parts, and it's an absolute must-see. And that was part of my Capaldi run, actually, before his doctor started. You know, I was getting up to speed on everything I could, Capaldi, and Children of Earth exceeded any expectation I ever had of, you know, Torchwood. And I had seen a bunch of Torchwood at that point. I liked it in some ways. There were episodes I didn't like. There were plot developments I didn't like, but there was some good acting. And probably one of my favorite episodes, by the way, there were a couple of, you know, Game of Thrones actors in there, and one of my favorites was the episode with the guy who played Sir Alistair Thorne in, it was a Chris Chibnall written episode. I can't remember the name of it, though, and it's in the first season of Torchwood. But it's really kind of scary and has a little bit of a Texas Chainsaw Massacre vibe to it.
I know the episode you're talking about. Unfortunately, I'm not as familiar with Torchwood as I probably should be, because Torchwood just didn't appeal to me outside of a few of those episodes. And, of course, obviously Children of Earth, which I think is one of the great pieces of Who-connected material ever written.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. It's just really, really brilliant. But, yeah, that would be my standout episode of Torchwood, just regular episodes rather than Children of Earth. So that one.
Yeah, I quite like the Time Flight. I don't want to call it Time Flight because there was an actual Doctor Who, but the one with the jet plane that brings the people through the time warp, and I thought that was very interesting.
I don't remember that very well. There's a lot of Torchwood that I just don't really remember very well. So, but the episode, you know, that had that Texas Chainsaw vibe is one of the memorable ones for me.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's definitely better for me than the pheromone alien episode.
Yeah, always got to have those pheromone aliens, huh?
Yes.
But yeah, there was some interesting stuff in Torchwood, but Children of Earth is really the high point, and it's one of the high points of anything Whovian.
It is very, very good. Did you ever see the Sarah Jane Adventures?
No, I didn't.
I've only seen some of the crossover episodes. I've seen the first set of episodes, and I saw the crossovers with the Doctor and maybe one or two other episodes. It's a very good children's show, but I don't think it's as essential viewing as, in terms of plot, as the show itself. But interestingly, while Torchwood is more in keeping with the dark side of Who, the appearances by the Doctor are very much worth seeing, and really do help flesh out those doctors in terms of their relationship to companions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I it's kind of interesting that the spinoffs from Doctor Who, you know, in that period that, you know, Davies was responsible for, Torchwood was aimed at an adult audience, the Sarah Jane Adventures was aimed at a children's audience, while Doctor Who kind of straddles that middle space, you know, trying to incorporate both audiences into the same space. And so it'll deal with dark themes, but never quite as dark as some of the darkest Torchwood stuff.
Yeah, Torchwood. Torchwood went some places, shall we say?
Yes, it did. It did.
And interestingly, that's not to say that Doctor Who has never had darkness, because it certainly has. You look at something like the horror of Fang Rock, and they kill off everybody except the Doctor and his companion. That's pretty damn dark.
Well, can I just tell you my first experience with Doctor Who here? Because, you know, this is going back, of course, to Hartnell, to the Dalek serial. It was called The Daleks, that very first serial that I saw. And it's like, it's pretty cheesy. I mean, you know, you've got this monster that has a, you know, plunger, a toilet plunger on it. But there's this moment in the episode, I think it's maybe in about the third or fourth part of the serial, where you realize, I mean, it's like they're trying to come to this resolution, this treaty between the Dalek people and the other people on the planet, whose name I don't remember, you know,
mm-hmm.
here on Skaro. And I don't remember if we know it's Skaro, it's called Skaro yet. But, you know, here we are trying to do this treaty. And then, you know, the representatives of the original people that, you know, the Doctor and his companions met, the other people on the planet, are all in this room. And then the Daleks turn on them with that exterminate. And it's the very first time this ever happens
Yep.
in the series. It's the very first time they kill all of those people in that room, all of the people that they're supposed to be doing this treaty with. And it turns out that the Daleks not only want to exterminate everybody who's of this race on the planet that's, you know, their enemy, but they want to just exterminate all things not Dalek in the universe. You know, they're not genocidal, they're omnicidal. And that was just stunning to me. I mean, it's like in the middle of all of this cheesiness to have a moment like that, and that's what actually sucked me into Doctor Who, was that moment, you know, that incredibly dark moment in the second serial they ever did. And this is what actually made all those kids in Britain, you know, go to their grocery. Yeah, hide behind the sofa, but also go see the Dalek exhibit at the local, you know, store or whatever, you know, because they kind of took him out on tour so kids could meet the Daleks, you know, and see the Dalek
Just like they had Beatlemania,
models.
There was Dalek Mania.
There was Dalek Mania right before Beatlemania, yeah, or right around the same time as Beatlemania in the UK. But, yeah,
yep.
It's just pretty amazing, you know. It's like immediately it became a phenomenon, and I can see why, you know, but it's an incredibly dark moment, you know, it's which is why the Daleks became one of my favorite, you know, monsters immediately, because they really are so dark. And
the Daleks are great when handled
properly.
The
Daleks are awesome. When they're handled properly, yes, they can be incredibly badly handled, as we know.
And unfortunately, Terry Nation, with I believe it was Destiny of the Daleks, an episode with Tom Baker in the late 70s where you see the Daleks fighting the Movolans, and it starts out with the Doctor and Romana leaving K-9 in the TARDIS because it was perched on a rock, and you know, it's just a bad episode. There's really pretty much nothing good about that episode.
That's unfortunate. Didn't he invent the Daleks, Terry Nation?
Yeah, Terry Nation invented the Daleks and then couldn't figure out what to do with them.
Well, it's kind of like Moffat and the Weeping Angels, isn't it? You know, it's like he invents the Weeping Angels for Blink and then wastes them in almost everything but The Angels Take Manhattan.
You know, I thought The Angels Take Manhattan had some interesting stuff in it, but I actually do like most of The Angels two-parter from Smith's first year.
Yeah, I didn't like that at all. Sorry. I don't remember why.
Fine, but I'm also one of the ones that prefers Aliens to Alien, even though as a rule I'm usually more about atmospheric ghost stories than visceral action.
Oh, okay. Yeah, your comment about Aliens over Alien makes sense. Yeah, that you would prefer, the two-parter. I'm alien over aliens, by the way.
Yeah, and usually I am, but I just, there's something about Aliens that it just works for me.
Yeah. It's good.
But,
it's...
Yes, go on.
Yeah. No, it's okay. It's okay. I'm starting to lose my voice.
No. We do need to wrap this up pretty soon. So I was just going to say that I think that covers, you know, we've covered a lot, except we didn't really hit on Jack Harkness, but we kind of did. And,
well,
you know,
he's in the best. Yeah, he's in Children of Earth. So just go see Children of Earth.
Yes. And if you need background on it, you can read up background on Jack and the other characters, maybe watch a few clips from other episodes, and then you'll be good to go.
Just watch The Empty Child and The Doctor Dances, and you get your origin point for Captain Jack. Yeah.
Yes.
I mean,
yes.
We actually are introduced to the character earlier, but we don't know it's him. We're introduced to him in like the very, very second episode, but we don't know it's him yet. We find out much, much, much later.
Yes, and for those who don't know, I'm not going to spoil that.
No, neither am I.
But I will say that I think that, you know, there's so much more we could do, but, you know, you're losing your voice, and I need to wrap this up. So I would like to thank you for coming on again, and perhaps we can have you back for another show at some point. But I do want to say that we will be back in 2 weeks with another episode, a broad look at a special topic. We aren't ready to announce what it is yet, but I think you guys will enjoy it. It's going to be a little different. We've hit a lot of British television this month with Doctor Who and Dennis Potter, and it's not going to be British television again. We're going to go and do something a little bit different next time. So I hope in 2 weeks everyone can join us for another episode. I hope you've enjoyed this episode. Thank you for listening. Please tune in next week. And once again, Cindy, thank you for showing up. And
yes, thank you for having me. Yeah, it was fun.
It was
that
a pleasure.
Was a lot of fun.
Oh,
thank you. It was a pleasure for me, too.
It always is. Take care, and good night, everybody.
Good night.
Bye-bye.